This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Hello there, how you doing? It's Kevin Riley here from the Irish Time programme on People's Radio and Manawatu People's Radio here in Palmerston North. I'm just going to be reading a lot of stuff about what's happening in Ireland. This is off the BBC Northern Ireland, the Irish Times and the Guardian, not the Guardian, what do you call it? The Independent. And there's a couple of other papers I used to try, but they keep, when you try to print stuff off, it just blank, blank, blank. It's, you know, paywalls, etc., etc. Anyway, here we go. This is just start off with something light, as it were. This is Irish population. This is the Republic of Ireland. More people are moving to Ireland than leaving as economic recovery continues, official figures suggest. Note the word suggest. There has been net immigration for the fifth year in a row. Between April 2018 and April 19, an estimated 88,600 people moved to Ireland, while 54,900 left. Between 2010 and 2014, more people left Ireland than moved there. It was, the 2008 kind of financial crash. Almost 30% of the Irish population, approximately 1.4 million people, live in Dublin. The recession meant that there was net immigration in Ireland before the trend returned to immigration in 2015. The return to net immigration is likely to be a direct result of the country's economic recovery. The Irish economy is still growing strongly, and some economists believe it is approaching technically full employment. During Ireland's economic boom, annual net immigration peaked at more than 100,000 in 2007. Net migration to the Northern Ireland has also reached its highest level in 10 years, according to new figures. The Central Statistics Office said the number of non-Irish nationals living in Ireland increased from 593,000 to 622,700, nearly 60, you know, nearly 23, which is 12% of the total population, 12.7. That's good. That's good to see. Of the non-Irish nationals, an estimated 115 are from the UK, 340,000 from elsewhere in the EU, and 169,000 from elsewhere in the world. James Haggerty, chief statistician, said the annual increase brought the population estimate to be 4.92 million in April 2019. The combined effect of positive net migration and sustained natural increases resulted in population growth of 64,500 to the end of April 2019. Mr. Haggerty said that all regions showed a population increase in the year to April 29, ranging from 2,600 people, 0.5% in the Midwest, to 25,100 in Dublin. Dublin seems to be the place where everybody wants to sort of head to. Interesting, 30% of the population live there. For some reason, I thought it might have been more. Anyway, still on Dublin. Huawei transfers mobile soft services to Ireland. Huawei has in recent months transferred many of its mobile software services to an Irish subsidiary called Aspigal, I think is how you say that, Aspigal Limited. Some industry insiders suggest the decision, which sees the Irish unit taking over responsibility for European users' personal data, is an attempt by the company to show it has nothing to hide when it comes to security concerns. Huawei Mobile Services, known as Huawei ID, in some markets allows users to access the company's specially designed smartphone apps and to store personal information, including payment details, in the cloud. Interesting, there are a lot of problems in other English-speaking countries, really. The services were transferred to the Dublin-headquartered subsidiary from the group's Shazan headquarters at the end of April, with the unit given responsibility for the business operations and development for all the group's mobile services outside of mainland China, and with a particular focus on Europe, one of its most important markets. The move follows a recent crackdown on the company in the US, and several other markets over security concerns. I think New Zealand's part of that as well. You know, Australia, America, what's the other one? And the UK. I mean, it's all the Anglo-Saxons, you know, who are, I don't know why, you know, they're all concerned about security, yet they're quite happy to employ security in their systems, you know, to sort of be a bit dicey about their own systems. They're not kind of 100% certain. Details around the decision to transfer the services to Dublin were disclosed during a media briefing for Irish journalists, led by their chairman at the telecoms equipment and smartphone makers' headquarters in southern China. The reason why Huawei has based its cloud center service for Europe and Ireland is because we have sold hundreds of millions of smartphones in Europe and we need to offer after-sales service and platform upgrade services to our customers. When we provide these services, we strictly comply with GDPR. No idea what that means. We also have a very close and transparent relationship with the Irish regulators regarding all our operations. Huawei, which is this week announced it is to invest €70 million in research and development activities in the Republic of Ireland over the next 3 years, has consistently denied allegations by the US government that its technology solutions can be used to spy on other countries. On other countries are companies, as if the Anglo-Saxon countries don't do that. During his briefing with the Irish journalist, Mr. Ping, the CEO, again reiterated this position. The attack from the US, a global superpower, is unethical and groundless. As the only superpower in the world, the US has mobilized resources across the country to crack down on our company. We are certainly feeling the pressure and pain from that decision. However, Huawei is doing everything it can to survive and thrive. The senior executive said he believed that after Brexit, Ireland will become a very important option for Chinese companies looking to build their European presence. That's an interesting point. The state was also well positioned to benefit from 5G and artificial intelligence, he added, and said Huawei will step up its investments in Ireland. Mr. Ping admitted the company had been a little slow in responding to cybersecurity concerns when they were initially raised. Frankly speaking, we don't expect to experience so many difficulties. We thought we would achieve business success if we made solid investments in technology and worked hard to serve our customers to the best of our ability. Therefore, we didn't make any big efforts to engage with the media to make sure people understood who we are. So that's going to be interesting that, with the Brexit, that, the Republic of Ireland and hopefully possibly not only but the North because of the Brexit situation could actually be some benefits for the economy. And this is something that's close to my heart because I was there about a year ago, just over when this fire started. A year ago, on a sunny, late summer's morning, a devastating fire broke out at one of Belfast's most prominent historic buildings. The blaze at the Primark store in the bank buildings started on August the 28th and burnt for 3 days. Like I said, you could smell it in the air when I was there. The fire had been erased. And it was possibly a week or two afterwards, but it was just the smell was unbelievable. 14 businesses were unable to trade for months, and the cordon at Castle Place led to a drop in food traffic in the retail heart of the city. A year on, and what do we know about the effects it had on Belfast? On Tuesday, a fire broke out at the top of the five-storey building at about 11. Flames clearly visible leapt from the roof of the building, while shoppers and Primark staff were quickly evacuated. The remaining floors were untouched by fire, but that was soon to change. Amazing, nobody was killed. I mean, it's quite a large building, the bank buildings. Within hours, the fire had spread to the bottom floor, completely destroying the building. Thanks to the quick evacuation, there were no injuries. At the height of the incident, more than 100 firefighters and 14 fire appliances were involved in tackling the blaze, including units from as far away as Armagh and Kilray. As they battled the fire throughout the day, onlookers stood in the surrounding city centre, kept at a safe distance by emergency personnel as the blaze devastated the building. Area Commander Adrian Jennings said it was a day he would remember. The size, scope and intensity of the fire provided many challenges, and I can vividly recall that iconic image of the clock in the bank building burning and the impact that had on our personnel working so hard to save the building. The fire burnt for 3 days. In June 2019, the Fire and Rescue Service announced its extensive investigation into the cause of the fire and had concluded that the blaze was accidental. It said it was not appropriate to be more specific about the actual cause of the accidental fire because of a wider investigation by the Health and Safety Executive. Someone said it was an accelerating battle, you know, when they were actually they're extending the building out the back or the store. And, you know, somebody left the gas on or something and it just ignited whatever reason. The health and safety confirmed that its investigation was still ongoing. At the time of the fire, the Primark store was being refurbished and extended to an estimated cost of £30 million. Why is the building so important? The Grade B1 listed building is one of the city centre's most recognisable landmarks. That's true. The original bank buildings was designed by Sir Robert Taylor and erected by Waddell Cunningham in 1785. W.H. Lynn, who was also responsible for the city central library and the Carlisle Monument, Methodist Church, designed the new building in 1900. With the building completely gutted and in danger of collapse, a safety cordon was imposed, which involved the closure of parts of Castle Street and Fountain Street. However, traders on those streets, as well as others in the city, were hit by the restricted access and lower numbers of shoppers. Yeah, well, you couldn't get anywhere. It was just kind of, you know, everything was shut down. By October, it was reported that the fire had led to a drastic dip in shopping footfall, foot traffic. According to Rashid Rahan, president of the Belfast Chamber of Commerce, its impact was greatest in the northwest side of the city centre, from Royal Avenue to Bank Square and Castle Street. Foot traffic in those streets was down by about a third, less so in other parts of the city. He added that the fire had the effect of galvanising support and prompted a coordinated action plan for a city recovery, led by the City Council. As the months went by, access improved. A tunnel opened in November that allowed shoppers to walk past the damaged building with shipping containers in place. Whoops. In case part of the building collapsed. By December, in time for the busy Christmas shopping period, a temporary walkway opened, allowing 8 businesses to pull their shutters back. The cordon was reduced again last February, allowing pedestrians to walk between Castle Street and Fountain Lane after more than 6 months of restricted access. Were people satisfied with the response to the fire? Belfast City Council faced some criticism from business people about what they saw as a slow response to the fire. The Lord Mayor of Belfast, John Fucane, said it had been a challenging 12 months for our city centre traders, particularly those who were directly impacted by the necessary cordon and road closures that resulted. Looking to the future, Councillor Fucane said the council can take our foot off the pedal. So what about me? I have to have the foot on the pedal to sort of improve the whole lot. Right, what I got this is from the Belfast Telegraph. This is about the Orange Order and about, you know, child abuse. And unusual. It's usually the Catholic Church, but this time it's the Orange Order. Two women who have said they were abused by Orange men as children claim the Orange Order did nothing when it was made aware of the allegations. In the latest revelations made in the Impartial Reporter newspaper as part of a long-running investigation into historic abuses in County Fermanagh. More than 50 victims had named 60 alleged abusers. A police task force has been set up to investigate the claims. The Orange Order said it would fully cooperate with any investigation. The two alleged victims said they were abused by several individuals who were Orange men and that the Orange Order was made aware of their allegations. They claim some of the abuse, which dates back several decades, took place in and around Orange Halls during band practice and after parades. Impartial Reporter Deputy Editor Rodney Edwards said victims believe there was a cover-up within the Orange Order, that certain individuals were protected because of who they were. Nothing unusual in that. That seems to be the norm today, protecting those who are people of influence and money. One of the alleged victims says that she was told that she was opening a can of worms by making these allegations and that she was threatening the name of the institution. One of the two alleged victims, referred to as Sarah, not her real name, also said she was raped by a member of the Orange Order after singing in church. She told BBC Northern Ireland News she approached church leaders and the Orange Order in County Fermanagh, but they did absolutely nothing. The church sent me to a religious counsellor, I believe this his title was, and he wanted to teach me how to pray for forgiveness, so I never went back. Wow. I went to one session, and at that point I was suicidal, and this man was asking me to pray for forgiveness, and that was like another slap in the face, which is ridiculous, but given the sort of, you know, the religious fanaticism here in the north of Ireland, it doesn't surprise me. Sarah said the people she told were out of their depth. I'm not making excuses for them, but people did not know what to do. I just wondered what had happened to be acknowledged and some form of punishment and then awareness. But that didn't happen either. There was no punishment that I know of given to the perpetrators. As far as I was concerned, I was being punished because I wasn't being listened to again. The more that happened, the more you withdraw and the less likely you are to speak out ever. So I was lucky in many respects. I am one of the lucky ones. A spokesman for the Orange Order said the allegations were very serious. Well, I'd like to think they are serious. The Orange Order will fully cooperate with the Police Service of Northern Ireland investigation team. It added that no further public comment could be made at this point. Sarah gave statements to the police in the late 1990s but said the investigation went nowhere. People were questioned. Eventually, I was asked to go to Belfast to meet the DPP, Director of Public Prosecution, and was told that lack of evidence, an old case, we were really sorry, but there's nothing we can do. And that was it. Go home. Wow. Sarah has been told by the new Police Service of Northern Ireland Task Force that it is re-examining her allegations. The police contacted me 3 months ago to tell me that they were reopening my case, but I had yet to be interviewed. I don't know if they've interviewed any of the other people I made allegations against. I just don't know what's happening. The Police Society of North Police Service of Northern Ireland confirmed that both cases had previously been investigated, subsequently directed upon by the Public Prosecution Service. Both cases were being reviewed to ensure all lines of necessary inquiry were completed at the time and determine if there were any new evidence is available. Detectives have maintained contact with the victims throughout. Doesn't sound like what the woman said, hadn't been in touch with her. And will continue to do so. The people should be assured that detectives treat every allegation of child sexual abuse seriously, whether it happened recently or many years ago. It said that obviously can be contacted on 101 or through a dedicated email service. So good luck to this woman, and hope she perseveres and gets to the bottom of the bottom of the whole issues, to the truth of the matter. Right, this is Brexit, because that is dominating the whole of the UK, including the Republic of that whole part of the world, really. You know, the UK and the Republic of Ireland. It's kind of it is the news. There is nothing else. This is about Parliament's suspension, you know. The government's move to suspend Parliament has been criticised by Sinn Féin, the SDLP, that's the Social Democratic Labour Party, the Ulster Unionist and the Alliance Party. But Democratic Unionist Party leader Eileen Foster welcomed the move. It emerged on Wednesday that the government would ask the Queen to suspend Parliament in September. That will make way for Boris Johnson's new administration to hold a Queen's speech laying out the government's plans on October the 14th. On Tuesday, opposition parties at Westminster agreed to work together to avoid a no-deal Brexit on the 31st of October. If Parliament is suspended, MPs are unlikely to have time to pass any laws that could stop the Prime Minister taking the UK out of the European Union without a deal. Isn't it? So they're really in a big pickle over there. I mean, it's amazing, you know, how these people ever won the Second World War. You know, I suppose there was a lot more unity than there is today. Sinn Féin has described the move to suspend Parliament as a callous political play. Conor Murphy, one of the party's senior members, said it meant a no-deal Brexit is now the most likely outcome and that Irish interests were not being protected. Mr Murphy said the Prime Minister's move was not aimed in any way at helping restore Stormont and said the DUP were foolish for backing Mr Johnson. SDLP leader Colm Eastwood said the move was disgraceful and very anti-democratic. In a letter to all MPs urging them to support a motion of no confidence in the Prime Minister, he said Mr Johnson doesn't care about the fragile complexities that underpin peace and prosperity in Northern Ireland. And that's very true, they're pretty fragile. The Deputy Prime Minister in the Republic, Simon Coveney, said the British government seems to be simply wiping the slate clean off the Irish issue. He said we can never sign an agreement that with that approach. So we're always said that if there is no deal Brexit, it will be the choice of a British Prime Minister and a British Parliament. We spent many months putting together a withdrawal agreement, which was a compromise on both sides, in order to get a fair deal for the UK and for the European Union. It protected the peace process on the island of Ireland and allowed the Republic of Ireland to stay in the EU single market while preventing physical border infrastructure re-emerging in the island of Ireland, which was a source of such tension in the past. But Democratic Unionist Party leader Arlene Foster welcomed the decision to hold a Queen's speech. The confidence and supply agreement her party struck in 2017 to support the Conservatives will be reviewed in advance of the new Parliament's session. The new session of Parliament will set up a new domestic legislative programme which can deal with the matters most important to people, such as their safety, their schools and their hospitals. You know, a lot of them be coming from Westminster because they don't have a government in the north. They're still kind of polarised, really. So I just find it a bit of a nonsense, really. You know, these people are still picking up a wage, quite a considerable one, and they don't have a job. You know what I mean? All the main decisions are made in Westminster. In the meantime, we will continue our work with the Prime Minister to strengthen the union, deliver a sensible deal, which as we exit the bureau and restore devolution in Northern Ireland. TUV Unionist Party leader Jim McGuire said it was time to get on with getting out. He said 3 years on, the patience of the people has been exhausted. But most people in the north of Ireland voted to stay, to remain in the European Union. Today's news would appear to bring us closer to implementing the will of the people. Assuming it plays out like that, today will be remembered as a good day for democracy. Some people, you know, are kind of deluded, to say the least. However, Naomi Long, the leader of the Alliance Party, said parliamentary democracy was being sacrificed on the altar of Brexit. She criticised the DUP for giving cover to this parliamentary coup. Also, Unionist leader Robin Swan called the suspension of Parliament an abusive process. Every piece of legislation that was in process has now fallen. There is no opportunity now for MPs to come back with any serious time for meaningful debate and challenge. I think it leaves Northern Ireland very much on the sidelines. I think the north of Ireland actually comes into it, as long as you've got the DUP supporting the government. And this is from a political reporter, Jane McCormick. This was more than a bolt from the blue. It was hard-hitting serve back across the court towards opposition MPs who want to block a no-deal Brexit. Already there's been an angry reaction from some of the Stormont parties who don't buy the government's argument that this is simply about getting on with getting out. A lot remains unclear about the coming days, but one thing is certain. Talks to restore Dublin before the Brexit deadline are bound to fade further into the background. And that's what I mean. These people picking up a salary and there's kind of, who do they represent, you know, when all the main decisions are made in Westminster. In a letter to MPs on Wednesday, Mr Johnson confirmed his government's intention to end Parliament's current session on the 10th of September in preparation for the Queen's speech. The letter also mentions the Northern Ireland Act, which includes a provision that the government must regularly debate reports on progress to restore Stormont. Mr Johnson confirmed that MPs would hold the first of these debates on September the 9th, one day before he wants Parliament to be suspended. It would not need to debate another report until after Parliament returned on the 14th of October. MPs have originally backed the provision being added to the Northern Ireland Act to make it harder for the government to prolong Parliament, but the dates specified in the Act coincide with the government's timetable for moving on. It's going to be interesting, you know, that there will be another election, because it really is, you know, the shit virtually has hit the fan now, so it's going to be interesting to see where all this sort of leads to. I just feel, you know, that the UK is on the, you know, on its not on its way out, but it's kind of losing face in the eyes of the rest of the world, and it's like America to me. They're not quite the country that they think they are. They're strong countries. There's no denying that economically, etc. But they sort of lack a certain je ne sais quoi. You know, it's kind of turning democracy on its head in many ways. Things that we used to take for granted. You know, except anyway, that's just my view. Here we've got. This is a book called Northern Ireland Ceasefire, 25 Years of Imperfect Peace. This is a book called Brian Rowan. He was an author and a former BBC Northern Ireland security correspondent in the north, and he'd been there for a long time, so he's quite a knowledgeable person, it would seem. On the 31st of August 1994, the IRA called its first ceasefire. The beginning of the end of a violent campaign that had already stretched into its third decade. By October that year, lawless paramilitary had followed suit. Brian Ronan was a correspondent at the time, and he was asked how much progress has been made. When we first read the ceasefire statements in 1994, could we have predicted the political and legacy wars of today? The latter being the long fight for the truth about the years of conflict. And to this, the battle that is Brexit. And the hope of 1984 is just what we expected. 25 years later, the political landscape and conversations are changing, and the ceasefires are but a moment in history, which is good. And let's hope it stays that way. With the wisdom of Hindsight, we know they were the beginnings of an imperfect peace, not the end. There were other phases of murder, new threats posed by the many and various types of dissident IRA. Those threats have again been evident in recent times. The murder of that journalist in Derry, a young woman. The current security and intelligence assessment is that all of the organisations that were part of the conflict or the troubles that are known continue to exist in some shape or form, some more obvious than others. They did not disappear in the peace. The ceasefire statements of 1994 seemed to offer so much more. Firstly, in August, the IRA declared a complete cessation of military operations. Then in October, the response came from the Combined Loyalist Military Command, an umbrella group of the Loyalist Paramilitary Forces, which included the UDA, the Ulster Volunteer Force, the Red Hand Commandos, and at a news conference in Belfast, the former Ulster Volunteer Force leader, Gusty Spanks, who died not that long ago, read a statement saying that it would cease all operational hostilities. He turned out to be a good guy. I think when they'd done time and they were in a long cache with a lot of other people, they just kind of realised that they're in the same country and they're from the same class, and that, you know, they weren't getting anywhere by annihilating one another. There was strength and unity of overcoming the divisions which were possible, and to get a better country, the north of Ireland, for everyone there, Catholic, Protestant, whatever. After the slaughter of 2.5 decades, which I estimated 3,500 people lost their lives, that was a moment of dream and a hope. Working as a BBC correspondent, I was called to a meeting on August where a woman read the IRA statement to me. And the night before, the announcement by the paramilitary organisations, I met senior loyalists and was given a statement by the former leader, Gusty Spence, pointing to an unprecedented press conference the following morning. The stage was set for a new day. Now, to mark the 25th anniversary of those ceasefires, I've conducted a range of interviews assessing the worth of 1994 through the lens of 2019. Jack McCarris, son-in-law of the late IRA, Brian Keenan, was twice jailed in the period spanning the mid-1970s through to the early 80s. Inside the Maze in 1981, he wrote and delivered an oration for the hunger striker Bobby Sands, reading it from a cell he shared at the time with IRA leader Brendan McFarlane. Today, he is a prominent figure in the Irish language community and a director of the project developing in the Galtack Quarter in Belfast. That's in the Falls Road, just past the Victoria, the Royal Victoria Hospital, if you know Belfast at all. He has deep background knowledge of the internal Republican debate in which led to the IRA ceasefire. Looking back, he says that a different approach should have been asked by Republicans. The war was over, and we should have said the war was over. The former prisoner also believes that the IRA leadership should have been given an order for its arms to be permanently dumped. He means that the weapons should have been buried by the IRA itself and not subjected to a protracted negotiation over decommissioning in which an international commission supervised. I don't agree with that. I think they needed some neutral party to make sure that the weapons were taken off the streets. The IRA became a bargaining chip in those decommissioning arguments and in the post-Good Friday Agreement, manoeuvres for a new government at Stormont. He argued his argument will be viewed as a narrow Republican one. Any political agreement was always going to include demand for illegal weapons to be destroyed. There's nothing wrong with that. In the here and now, politics have moved beyond the decommissioning, but there are new arguments which brought about the collapse of the partial agreement in 2017. These disputes, including the demand for an Irish Language Act, still divide the two big parties, the Democratic Unionist Party and Sinn Féin. I just don't see the problem there, you know what I mean? It's a language. They're not training people to be terrorists. I asked him if there could be a restoration of the political institutions with such an act. Well, of course there can be, but there shouldn't be. It isn't about an Irish language. It's about the ability or inability of unionists and the Northern State to organise or make explicit recognition of the legitimacy of an Irish identity, which, when we think of it, it was at the heart of the entire conflict. Retired Church of Ireland Archbishop Lord Ames produced a background role in the events that led to the Loyalist ceasefire announcement, including speaking to then Prime Minister John Major in the Taoiseach Albert Reynolds. Loyalists had given the church wanted a set of conditions, which if they were met, we would allow them to, for the Seaside to proceed. So good on him. 25 years on, Liam believes that the looming prospect of Brexit is changing dynamics across the islands, and the old certainties are being eroded. Surveying today's bleak political landscape, I like that, bleak. I'm praying that the spirit of the ceasefire days could possibly infiltrate political life today. I asked him if the union was still safe in 2019. I would like to say it is, but I believe there are danger signs, which I think we're all conscious of. The frame of the political debate in Northern Ireland is widening. No longer is it just about devolution and torment or direct rule from Westminster, but about a new Ireland, which might look like, and how it might embrace unionists. New thinking is welcome. You don't have to surrender your principles or the principles you have been brought up to simply grasp new ideas. I'd like to know a bit more about what is meant by the new Ireland, but I can see possibilities. A decade in 2009, Lord Holmes helped to produce the first report aimed at establishing a process to address the questions about the conflict period. His team proposed the setting up of a legacy commission and, more controversially, a £12,000 payment to the relatives of all those killed in the conflict. But 10 years on, the waiting for such a process continues, and we are watching a legacy war, a fight for the past in which the trenches are being dug deeper. Anyway, that finishes me for the day. I'll keep this and I'll read this back next week, okay? My time is up, as I say. Anyway, it's been good to talk to you, and hopefully you're listening, and you will keep in touch with the Manawatu People's Radio, and let me know how you get on, because I would love to hear about any views or opinions, or if, like I've said before, if you've been back over the island or whatever, just for a holiday, whether you're Irish or not, but you've been over there for a holiday or a break to catch up with family or relations, whatever, and you'd like to talk about, just come on down to the studio. I'd love to sort of have a bit of crack with you. I mean, there'd be no political stuff. It'd just be you telling your story, what you saw and what you thought of, wherever it is, Dublin, Cork, Galway, or else somewhere in the north. Okay, I'll see you later. Bye.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.